Hi, it's Dacker. If you're like me, you probably have a wide variety of interests when it comes to your podcast listening. A little psychology here, a little history there, which is why I want to recommend a show perfect for those with eclectic tastes. Freakonomics Radio has more than 10 years and 500 episodes worth of answers to your biggest questions. But don't be fooled, it's not just for economists and business experts. Every week, Stephen Dubner dives into the hidden side of everything. With the help of guests, including CEOs, artists, and Nobel laureates, he breaks down all sorts of things, like how we choose the people we marry and why using swear words might be more important than you think. So don't miss out. Follow Freakonomics Radio right now, wherever you get your podcasts. The Science of Happiness is proudly brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Discover the latest findings in neuroscience, cosmology, and the origins of life at templeton.org.
I love my job. I love what I do. Sometimes I make it everything in my life, which I'm realizing is very unhealthy.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji, and today we're asking this question. Why is it so hard to talk about Israel?
I am the co-host and senior producer of NPR's Code Switch podcast, and we talk about race, identity, and culture on the podcast. And actually, the podcast has become one of the most popular things that we make. And lots of young people of color download it and listen, which is a wonderful thing. And it's also a lot of pressure because when you're doing this kind of work, when you're talking about race, when you're talking about something that people feel like you're implicating them in what's wrong or what's going wrong, and people take things that you say very personally into heart and maybe lash back out at you, whether that's over social media or like emails about your work because they don't like it, because they feel uncomfortable about it, because it makes them feel bad. That happens a lot, and I always get really sensitive about that, and I get even more sensitive when they're so hungry to see themselves reflected at all. And you'll get those emails that are like, you got this wrong, or, you know, you forgot to say this thing or that thing about my experience. I spend a lot of outsized time worrying about everything involving my job. I mean, to the point where, like, my therapy sessions, 40 minutes of the 50 minutes is involved with me talking about work, right? And not me talking about my life outside of work. It's like this sick thing where it makes me feel like I have to be better. I have to do better. I always have to be better. What did I do wrong that I can make better? And that's what keeps me up at night. It's like that anxiety over, okay, I messed it up again. Here's proof. Tweets, emails, people at work telling me whatever it is I did wasn't the best. And it's just like that fuel that keeps me ambitious, but also keeps me unhappy.
I'm Dacher Keltner, host of The Science of Happiness. We all receive criticism, and it often stings, and it can feel overwhelming, like when it's about our work performance.
Or our parenting.
That's Shuka Kalantari, our senior producer. Hey, Shuka.
Hey, Dacher. I've been thinking a lot about criticism while working on this episode, and how if someone even insinuates that I'm a bad mother, I kind of freak out and stay up all night thinking about it.
I know there's a lot of pressure on moms these days, and you have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old?
That's right, and the 6-year-old has joined in on the parenting criticism these days. Here's what he said to me the other day.
Mama, parents like you tell everybody what to do, and it breaks my heart.
Ouch. Wait till they're teenagers, but it starts early, doesn't it?
I guess so. But even when people I don't care about criticize my parenting, I feel super panicked and can't stop thinking about it. Exactly like what Shireen describes happens to her when she gets criticism about her podcast, Code Switch.
And in fact, that's one of my daughter's favorite podcasts these days because of how it covers race.
I love it too. So tell me, Dacher, what's going on when we hear criticism from a scientific perspective?
You know, Shuka, we've learned a lot about the fight or flight response that causes you to feel panicked, what happens in your body, and, you know, cortisol, the stress hormone, is released. It activates your heart. And we're also learning that two regions of the brain, the amygdala and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, are really involved in panic. So the amygdala picks up information about very basic threats to our survival, And then Naomi Eisenberger down at UCLA is finding that the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex detects more social threats, right? Like somebody's criticism or a snarky remark from a teenager or a rejection on the playground.
So these regions tend to work overtime when we're processing criticism?
Yeah, and that's what's really unnerving about this is that, you know, when we feel perpetually threatened or criticized or rejected, those regions of the brain are always active and humming and getting our stress-related regions of our body activated.
Okay, so how can we stop our brains from responding this way?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the central pathways to happiness is the things we can do that really help us countervail stress and these bodily responses. And that's what Shireen Marisol Meraji, our guest today, tried to do. Shireen tried a practice to empower her to deal with the kind of criticism that she faces at work and from her audience, known as the affirming important values practice. She started out by sharing the steps on how to do it.
Okay, so this is how you do it. It says that it requires 15 minutes. I found that it took longer, but that's maybe just for me. So there's a list of values that you're given. There's 11. And what it says in the practice is that you should start ranking the 11 values in order of their importance to you.
Okay.
So that was the first thing I did. And then it says that you should write an account of, you know, why your number one value, the one that you chose to be number one, is important to you, and then include a time when it played an important role in your life. It said in the description that it was good if you were feeling like if your ego was taking a little bruising. If something happened to make you feel bad about yourself, this would be a really good practice to help remind you what's important in your life.
I mean, when you're reporting on diversity and race and identity, you're in tough territory, I can imagine. You know, well, you chose well because the science by people like Dave Sherman down at UC Santa Barbara finds like this simple practice of affirming your personal important values help you with stress and calm your body down and help you with actually criticism and negative feedback. So it's a good choice. Was it hard to rank these 11 values? They're tricky.
Yes, like, it was.
Like creativity and athletics, social skills. What'd you choose?
My number one value was relations with friends and family.
What came in number two?
Well, I put romantic values, but the way that I thought of it was like my relationship with my partner, my husband.
Uh-huh.
So basically, number one, relations with friends and family. I mean, it was kind of like together. I didn't know what to do. That's like all the same. And with my partner.
Uh-huh.
So that's all number one. And then it was creativity, social skills, sense of humor, spontaneity, living life in the moment, artistic aesthetic appreciation, business managerial skills, athletics, musical ability, and physical attractiveness. And these are based on the ones that were given.
And I'm really curious, you know, just thinking so much about culture and coming from a bicultural background, did you feel the influences of your different cultures and your background shaping how you looked at these values?
Are you kidding? Do you know how many times my dad would say, and I can't do his accent, and it's also not cool to do people's accents anymore, but I used to like try and do my dad's accent. He's Iranian. He would say all the time, family first.
Yeah.
I mean, family specifically. Like the idea that we had friends was so, it was like breaking his brain. The fact that friends were a thing that we thought was important. So I definitely feel like when I was ranking this, to write it out, it would be family and then friends. Well, family and then husband. Oh my God, my husband's going to kill me. Family and husband, but he is my family.
Yes.
So I feel like those are the same.
Yeah.
And then friends. And I think that that is really definitely cultural.
Yeah.
And it's something that was, from both sides, really important.
Yeah.
To make family number one and make family and closeness with your family and real connection, deep connection, and to devote time and to making those connections strong. And I feel like I actually haven't been doing a really good job at that.
Yeah.
And this helped me pinpoint that. Mm. And I want to change that.
That's great. So you're supposed to write about a time that you had a positive experience with your number one value. What did you write about?
I had a conversation with a senior manager at work that just made me feel weird and odd and insignificant, incredibly. And so I was like, oh, this is the perfect time to try this practice. And so I did that. And the day before I had this conversation. I was out on my street and I was hanging out with my neighbor whose kid is my godson. She's dear friends with me. And so I wrote about like how amazing I felt being together and how kicking the ball back and forth across the street, even in this social distancing situation that we're in, and just like yelling back and forth across the street was just so wonderful, and how wonderful it made me feel, and how her asking me to be her child's godparent and what that has brought to my life and the kind of joy that has brought to my life is so much more important and fills me with so much more, I know, it makes me feel significant, makes me feel like I matter in a way that this conversation with my boss felt so insignificant. Rather than making me feel insignificant, it made me realize that that conversation was insignificant. I wrote about two things in this journal entry. My best friend, Rena, I wrote about how there was a time when I had my first broken heart and I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep. And she was there to help me nurse my broken heart. And she took really good care of me and she encouraged me to keep living and, you know, doing things that mattered to me. And I had signed up for this trip through San Francisco State at the time to go to Cuba. And I didn't want to go because I was so upset. Like, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is so devastating. My heart is so broken. I don't want to go on this trip. And she was like, I think this is the best thing for you. This is something you've been wanting to do. You should do this. And she encouraged me to take this trip, which really changed my life.
How so?
Because, first of all, it really helped me understand that, oh, when I was there, I was like, these are the kinds of stories that I want to tell. I want to tell the stories of the people that I meet in my travels and in my experiences. And also, I felt like coming out of that trip, I was definitely the best self. Like, I am my best self, and I'm putting myself out into the world, and I'm trying new things, and I'm challenging myself. And I can only do that if I know that I have a strong support network, and that support network who encourages me to be my very best self, people like Rena, people like my husband, people like my mom and my dad and my grandparents and my theos and thities and like my cousins, because we're a tight family and there's a lot of us. They're the people who help me be the best person that I can be. And that's what matters to me in my life, is showing up for them. And they in turn show up for me, and we show up for each other. And I don't think that I could even be in a place where I could obsess over criticism from work if I didn't have this really, really strong support network that has always been like, you can do it, and has encouraged me and has been there for me. And so that is why it's so important to remember that, because that's who matters and that's what matters.
You know, as you like rank order these values and you put, you know, your relationships and romantic values up top and some of the other values come at the bottom. Did you learn things about yourself in this present moment in your life, Shereen?
Yes. I mean, you know what I learned, which was very, didn't make me happy, but it was that I've ranked them in this order and I don't actually live my life in that way.
Yeah.
I don't actually spend the majority of my time doing what is my number one value, which is relations with friends and family and my husband. And that is not what I'm spending my time doing. I'm spending my time working. And I think my work is really important. I want to do work that helps people and helps the world. But if my number one value is relations with friends, family, loved ones, I'm not doing what I need to be doing to make that the most important value in my life, if that makes sense.
Do you notice that you were better able to handle criticism since doing this practice?
Actually, I just received a direct message on Twitter from somebody who I worked with about more than 15 years ago, who I haven't heard from in a really long time, who decided to reach out to give me some thoughts about a podcast episode that I edited. And also, by the way, when somebody reaches out to tell you they have thoughts about something that you made, and they don't just say, hey, that was awesome, you pretty much know criticism is coming. And I handled it so much better than I would have handled it before doing this. I do think what this exercise has done has helped me understand this person who I haven't spoken to in many, many, many years, wanting to give me unsolicited criticism. No, it's my mother, my father, the people who I love in my life. Those are the people whose opinions I value. So I think it actually really helped me. I didn't spiral out of control. I would have. That type of thing. And this is a very successful person in the industry. And I would have taken that and kind of spiraled out of control. But I had a moment where I was like, no, this is not that important to me. Like, okay, yes, interesting. I hear what you're saying. That's an interesting point. I'll think about that. Not all night, keeping me up all night. So I think that this exercise has helped in that way, put things into perspective.
You know, one of the things I like about these practices is they, you know, we kind of know this, like you have to live according to your values. Values matter. They organize your lives, et cetera. And these practices often, you know, they get us to do things that we haven't done for a while, like just think about what matters. What do you think your biggest takeaway is from doing the affirming important values practice?
I think that what it helped me do was take a step back and say, okay, if this is my number one value, if my number one value is family, why am I obsessing so much about work? It helped me think, what is important in my life? The fact that I've spoken to my father this week, who has Parkinson's, who may not be with me for very much longer. Like, to have called up my grandparents, who don't have much more time left on this planet, and to think, those are the people that I should be connecting with, and I'm not connecting with them, and they are upset with me, and they are probably like, where has she been? And that's the kind of criticism that I should be more worried about than the kind of criticism that I'm getting from the public who may not have liked the way I told a story, or my boss who, you know, may want me to work in a different way, or whatever it is, or a boss who didn't listen to my last story and I'm very upset because they didn't hear this great thing that I made. And so I think that what this has done is really make me stop and think about what's really important to me and how I'm going to strengthen the relationships and bonds with the people that are truly, truly, truly the people that are important to me. And if my value is family and friends, then I need to change my life to bring them up to the top of the list, because the way I'm living my life right now, they're at the bottom of the list.
I hear you. Well, Shireen, I know you're working very hard on your show Code Switch, and I know so many people who are empowered by that show, and I know you're handling all the complexities of covering race and diversity and culture in today's climate. So I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to be on our show.
Thank you. This was great. This really did help me.
So how does the Affirming Important Values practice work? More up next. Writing about her core value helped Shireen Marisol Meraji take a step back so she could put criticism into perspective.
Affirmations allow me to have a higher sense of self-worth, or a broader sense of self-worth, so that incoming information is something I can deal with.
Chris Casillo is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says that when we reflect on our core values, it activates a reward region of our brains, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. That's the part of our brains that helps us regulate our emotions, make decisions, and it's involved in the experience of feeling reward.
When I expose you to information you might not necessarily want to hear, but I'm trying to persuade you, I really want the most activity I can get in a reward region, right? Because then it suggests that you find value in the information that I'm telling you. So the whole idea is, can we use an affirmation to essentially boost the signal in these reward regions during message exposure, and then hopefully that will get people more likely to change their behavior and more likely to think about the message in an optimal sort of way.
In one study, Chris and his team had people who weren't that physically active choose their top value from a list given to them. Afterwards, they were put into fMRI brain scanners and prompted to think about a time that they had experienced that core value.
So it's remembering something you did last week or a month ago or last year.
Then came a threatening critical message.
It was something that said, hey, you know, you're sedentary, this is really bad for you in the future. You know, you could develop heart disease, you need to become more active, something of that nature.
Chris and his colleagues had a different group of people in the study write about values that weren't very important to them. At the end of 5 weeks, they found that those who reflected on their top value not only felt less threatened by the health warnings, they are also more likely than the other group to be physically active after the study ended. In a similar study, people were instructed to think about experiencing a core value in the future, and interestingly enough, it activated the reward region of the brain even more than when thinking about it from the past. Essentially, thinking about experiencing core values in the past or future helps us regulate our emotions so we can deal with stress a lot better.
So it allows you to basically regulate your emotions, calm down, not get defensive, and then think through how you want to deal with that information. Right? Do I want to change my behavior? Or maybe I don't, but I'm still engaging with the information. So I think that's how affirmations allow you to have a broader sort of network of how you want to deal with the information, a larger toolbox, if you will.
I'm Dacher Keltner. Thanks for joining me on The Science of Happiness. If you'd like to try the Affirming Important Values practice, visit us at greatergood.berkeley.edu/podcasts. Our podcast is a co-production of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and PRX. Our senior producer is Shuka Kalantari. Production assistance is from Jenny Cataldo and Ben Manila of BMP Audio. Our associate producer is Nina Sparling. Our executive producer is Jane Park. Our editor-in-chief is Jason Marsh. Our science director is Emiliana Simon-Thomas. Share your thoughts using the hashtag #happinesspod or emailing us at greater@berkeley.edu. Support for The Science of Happiness comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/happiness. That's odoo.com/happiness. Odoo, modern management made simple. From PR.